Hey everyone, welcome back to ZCast. I've had a week. There's been a lot of stuff that's happened behind the scenes. One of the big things that's happened is I've had like absolute psychic whiplash from getting laid off to getting a job offer to getting contract work, and I don't know how to feel about a lot of it. There's this saying that everything happens so much, and just over the last week, I have been really feeling that everything has been happening a lot, but I want to assert that I'm okay. I'm going to be okay, and just got to get through this one day at a time. I'm in a much better space than I was even at the last episode, and I'm going to make it. As I mentioned, I'm doing contracting now. If you want me to help you with your developer marketing stuff, the bad news is that you can't have me this year because I'm already full up for the year. I am going to be open in Q1 2025, so just start poking me around December, and when your budget's reset, then we can probably work something out. Oh, hey, I'm sponsoring myself. Either way, I have been working on a bunch of stuff. I have an article in the pipeline, several articles in the pipeline, actually, and I'm just plodding along, taking some time to chill, been playing a lot of Peglin. One of the things I want to discuss today is a Discord bot that I made called Mimi. If you are in the Patreon Discord, you'll notice that there's a channel called #Mimi, and that channel is where the Discord bot Mimi lives. Mimi is an AI chatbot. When you mention her by name, she will reply with an AI model, and if it's relevant, she'll use some tools like drawing an image with Flux Dev or running a Python interpreter compiled to WebAssembly and stuff in order to get a response. I've been using it as a way to explore some AI things and research how people interact with AI chatbots. The interesting part is that Mimi actually started out at some prompt engineering with Olama, and then I turned it into a Discord bot because I figured the results were amusing enough that it should be shared. Over time, I've added some more stuff to Mimi, and the overall goal is to make something that's amusing and useful in a couple limited ways. The big other things that Mimi does besides fabricate nonsense with Hermes 3 is it will listen. It has an HTTP ingress set up to the public internet, and it listens for updates from status page for a couple places and pipes them to various Discord channels. And if you post a AGIF image, it will automatically convert it to JPEG for you, except I broke that. Yeah, I'm gonna need to figure out how to fix it. I'm pretty sure that it's something really dumb. It's always the dumb thing. It's never the exciting thing. I guess it's fine. I mostly tried to separate out a lot of Mimi's areas of concern so that it would be useful for what I need, but also have some separation in everything to just make the code a little bit more organized. Oh yeah, the other big thing that it does is it connects to IRC and notifies people when I post new blog posts. But yeah, it's powered by Go, Kubernetes, has some user space WireGuard components to bridge over into Fly.io, and some Fly.io GPUs. Mostly in Olama instance on an A180GB, so I can take advantage of Hermes 3 at, I think I do it at 32K context. Pretty sure I do 32K. But Hermes 370B at 32K, which uses up most of the GPU's VRAM. It also takes like a minute to load all the weights from disk into memory, and it can make Mimi somewhat narcoleptic at times. But yeah, other than that, the other main weird thing it has is a copy of the Python interpreter compiled to WebAssembly inside it. And that allows me to do code interpreter without the risk of it revealing my home IP address or doing horrible things like damage to the container that it's running in. Getting the WebAssembly stuff set up was actually really easy, now that I think about it. The hardest part was finding a copy of the CPython interpreter compiled to WebAssembly that wasn't just 150 megabytes of WASM blob. I ended up looking through a bunch of different options and found one made by VMware that seems to be like 25 megabytes. It includes the full Python standard library. It's not able to install packages with pip or reach out to the public internet because it's running with WASI, and WASI doesn't have networking support, at least in the way that you would need in order to use an HTTP client, which kind of sucks, but it works. It is completely solid. It does what I need to, and I'm enjoying it. I think the weirdest part was figuring out the way to properly instruct the model on how to deal with the output of the Python code. The annoying part about having models work together with tools is that when you return something from a tool, you will need to have an instruction for the model on what to do with the result. The Python interpreter thing writes some code to a temporary directory, calls it main.py, mounts that into the WAS0 environment, runs Python with main.py as the program, as the arguments to, you know, CPython. If there is an error, it instructs the model to include the code and any standard error or platform errors in code fences. And when it finishes things successfully, it says that you include the user code output in any standard error or platform error in code fences. And I have found that this makes Mimi a bit more reliably able to do things. I haven't gotten it totally consistent. I probably need to test this against like Claude or GPT-4.0 just to see if this is a unique property of using Hermes at the quantization level that I do, or if it's just I'm doing something incredibly wrong. I'm probably doing something incredibly wrong, but my defense, it's very difficult for best practices to evolve because everything keeps changing so damn much. I'm going to see if I can show this off at the AI Tinkerers meetup this week in Ottawa. That should be fun. I love that meetup. Kind of weird that it's really early this month, but it happens. One of the things I wanted to research with Mimi is adding a filter model into the mix. A filter model is a concept that researchers at Facebook came up with, where you have user input go through the filter model, and if the filter model says it's good, then it goes through to the actual model. The actual model does things, and then it gets run through the filter model to see if that's good. And if all is good, then it gets the input end to end. And this allows you to avoid the model telling people how to make explosives or other obviously things that you would not want to be associated with your AI project. The main problem with LlamaGuard, though, is that we've run into some really, really weird false positives. LlamaGuard errs on the side of overly sensitive rather than underly sensitive. So as a result, you ask it to write some Python code and it says, no, you can't do that. That's child exploitation or something. And that's created some interesting results. I don't really know why that would happen, but this is also something with an incredibly inscrutable core. So I don't think anybody knows why that would happen. The interesting part, though, is when assistant responses get filtered, it ends up logging that to, you know, the log stream in Kubernetes, and you end up seeing that, yeah, sometimes people really do get the model to be able to tell you how to make a pipe bomb, and you just don't want that to get through. Either way, when I had LlamaGuard set up, I had it set up so that the LlamaGuard model was running on my home lab, and that would run on an RTX 3060 and reply functionally instantly. Actually, really cool to see it in practice. When I was adding stuff to Mimi for drawing images with Flux Dev or the code interpreter thing I was harping on about, I was trying to figure out ways to do it with existing off-the-shelf models and code models and other things and Olama's JSON grammar support, and I just wasn't able to get it working reliably. And then Olama dropped tool use, and that changed a lot of things because that meant that I could just give it just JSON descriptions of the tools, and then the model would call that. The only problem is that when I enabled tool use in Llama 3.1, all of the personality that Mimi had just evaporated, and you can tell that it went back to being, you know, the generic helpful assistant that just has no personality. And I kind of want my AI creation to have personality, for it to have like its own place in the ZYASO.net canon. And that was really frustrating at first. Of course, everything got fixed the moment that I slapped Hermes 370B into the mix, and that has been basically perfect for everything I need to do. I have been following the people at NewMA for a while, and they make some good models. I'm not entirely sold on their ideas that synthetic data and training models on synthetic data is the future, because I just don't know why. It's just like a vibe thing. The vibes are off for me with using synthetic data. Well, I guess the main reason why people would want to use synthetic data is that we've effectively hit a wall with how good we can make AI models. And that wall is about the level of GPT-4. And it seems that in order to get another order of magnitude improvement like we had from GPT-3 to GPT-4, we need 10 times the tokens to train it on. And the problem is we are running out of tokens to be able to train it on. We have exhausted human language and the output of humans. There's just not enough information to train it on. This is the reason why people are opting to use synthetic data to train their models, because it allows you to get lots of different variants of existing utterances so that you can have more data to train a model off of. But I just don't know if that will actually help or end up hurting along the way. The real solution here is to pay humans in order to write the things that you need, but the other problem is that at the scale and level of expertise that you would need in order to have a giant leap in quality, like from GPT-3 to GPT-4, you basically need to have a jobs program with the population of China. And that's not sustainable, not in the slightest. That there is no universe in which that can be anything close to sustainable. I just don't know how I feel about a lot of this. At some level, as you know, someone who basically makes their money doing creative endeavors online, I'm kind of happy that there's not going to be the generational improvement that threatens my job anytime soon. The vibes are off. I'm pretty sure the vibes are off with investors too. And whenever I do this stuff, I try to go out of my way to make sure that it would not replace human labor. There's just lots of really interesting, complicated feelings to have with it. And I suspect that this is something that I'm just going to have to learn to live with for better or worse. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I have had a whiplash of a week. In the course of that, I've had something emphasized to me again. I don't remember who, but way back in my IRC days, I remember someone telling me that what I was saying had some really interesting implications and that I should write it out long form and publish it on a blog so that they can share it with some of their friends because they liked it. And I did that. And I haven't stopped doing that. Doing that consistently as I have has been one of the best things that I've done for my career. Even though I don't get like super giga amounts of readers, I get a lot of them. And apparently I get them in the right places, because when I found out that I was jobless and something got changed in a Discord server as a result, I got a cold email from a startup founder asking me if I wanted to contract for them. If you're listening to this, you know who you are. Thank you so much. I'll look at the form and sign it on Monday. I don't do work on the weekends. But it's just so interesting to see it come to pass that this thing that I initially was told by some people was a waste of time and that I shouldn't do it is now like one of the main ways I get employed, and the sole reason why I'm able to go from laid off to not just a part-time contract offer, but an actual job offer within a week. Maybe someday I'll tell this whole story there. I'm just gonna wait a bit, and I'm gonna be starting work again next month. And for the rest of this month, I am just chilling out, playing Peglin, doing more Black Myth Wukong. I'm also going to work on some Kubernetes stuff while I have the time. I think that there is a huge market gap in the Kubernetes content space, where a lot of stuff covers the small scale, like running Minikube or Kind on your machine in order to mess around and run some stuff locally, or run a copy of Valky or Postgres or something and port forward it to your app so that you can do development. And the super big, like run your cluster on Google Kubernetes Engine or Amazon Kubernetes Engine or Azure Kubernetes Engine or DigitalOcean Kubernetes or Vulture Kubernetes or Linode Kubernetes or whatever. And I think that the content gap that I want to go for is Kubernetes in a home lab. I don't know if this is an industry term DART or something, but I've been starting to view the videos I make into a couple categories where they're short form, where it's 60 seconds and less. And there's mid form where it's 5 minutes and less. And there's long form where it's anything over 5 minutes. And most of the time when I make videos, I try to go for the long form because I feel it gives me enough room to properly express nuance and whatnot. But for Kubernetes stuff, I want to try making a few mid form videos where I cover a concept and how to use it, like putting a deployment on Kubernetes and then attaching a service so that you can connect to Postgres from your app. And I'd like to make those in such a way that I get both horizontal and vertical video out of it. And then I can make that for both YouTube and TikTok, probably post it on X or LinkedIn or whatever in the process. I kind of want to make a bunch of mid-form videos so that way it's lower commitment, lower overall effort, and easier for me to go and make a bunch of them in a burst and then schedule them out ahead of time. My goal for this is to get compute, storage, network ingress, and Postgres up and have that just be an example of how you would do this thing. Oh, I got suggested another one of those LinkedIn collaboration or collaborative articles to contribute to. Long-term employees are resisting cloud adoption. How can you effectively manage their resistance? Understanding and addressing the concerns of long-term employees is key to successful cloud adoption. Here are strategies to ease the transition. Conduct tailored training sessions that respect their experience while showcasing the benefits of cloud technology. And foster open dialogue to hear their concerns and provide reassurance about job security and new opportunities. Implement change gradually, allowing employees to adjust at a comfortable pace. What strategies have worked for you in managing resistance to new technologies? So I guess a lot of the thing that people would be afraid of here is that there are a lot of people in traditional system administrator jobs where their job has been to manage the server, update packages, install new software, and do that, like manage user accounts and do that across a fleet of physical servers that you can look at. And for people of this mindset, the cloud can be kind of scary because you can't look at the servers. You can't physically manage them. And if you want to go and make a bunch of them, you have to actually start coding and do more than you can with just a single machine in Perl. You have to learn CloudFormation. You have to learn Terraform. You have to learn like how to dynamically provision machines in your configuration management stuff. You have to figure out how to tell which machines belong to what thing, and you can't just segment it by IP space or whatever, because that gets automatically determined for you at a VPC level. Sure, a lot of the cloud stuff does offer you a lot of flexibility, but people from more traditional system administrator mindsets are kind of right in being skeptical about the cloud having benefits, especially because when you purchase stuff from the cloud, you're literally purchasing somebody else's hardware and just a chunk of it for yourself. However, in practice, I think this isn't actually as much of a problem as people make it out to be, mostly because of the difference between capital expenditure and operational expenditure. Capital expenditure is when you're buying things like servers, and operational expenditure is when you're either paying people or buying services. And in general, there is a fixed capital expenditure for compute that you can buy at any given time. You only have so much money that you can use to buy servers. That's just how it is. And one of the main benefits of cloud stuff that I don't know if a lot of more traditional system and types realize is that it allows you to effectively be able to expend your compute past the size of your capital expenditure budget. If it's Black Friday, you're on the front page of Reddit and you're going viral on TikTok at the same time, you can just spin up billion T computers to be able to handle the load, assuming that the rest of your stack is able to handle that. Terraform kind of sucks. I'm not going to lie. You all know it. I know it. Terraform sucks. But once you get used to it, it's not that bad. I do wish that Terraform and configuration management systems integrated together a lot better, because holy crap, having to deal with Ansible and Terraform together, there's a reason it's called the terrible stack. But the Torment Nexus did suggest something kind of decent, though. Implement change gradually. The other downside of implementing change gradually is the whole unique versus standard paradox that I described in the last episode. I don't know if there's really any way around that in terms of moving between paradigms. I'm running into some of that unique versus standard stuff myself as I have been transitioning my workloads off of my existing setup with my home lab into moving things into Kubernetes. And now that the Kubernetes approach has become standard, the legacy way is unique, and this is really annoying in practice. I'm going to work around it. I'll be fine. It's just kind of irksome. I think I am out of material for this week. Thank you so much for subscribing to Zcast, and make sure to get your 5,000 steps in. Stay frosty, yo.